there was nothing special about the genetics. As soon as these societies would transition into, you know, a modern sort of Western diet, they too would get the very same diseases. You know, some of these doctors like Albert Schweitzer, who, you know, stayed in Africa for decades. When he first got there, he said, you know, direct quote, "I was astonished by the absence of cancer." But, you know, 2 decades later, he was starting to see it. And you've seen obesity, you've seen diabetes. So it was clearly something, you know, I think clearly something related to diet. But even then, it's extremely hard question because we eat many different things and it's, you know, famously difficult to figure out which one is responsible for cancer.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Live Longer World, a podcast where we unite to boost longevity and fight aging. I am your host, Astha Jain, and I am so thrilled to be bringing this information to you today. If you wish to support this podcast, you can do so by signing up as a premium member and receive transcripts of each episode. You can find more information at livelongerworld.com/premium. To find all previous podcast episodes, my newsletter posts, and other resources, you can head over to my website, livelongerworld.com. With that, let's get started with today's episode. My guest today is Sam Apple, who is the author of the book Ravenous, the story of Otto Warburg, the Nazis, and the search for the cancer-diet connection. Otto Warburg was a Nobel Prize-winning German scientist during the era of Hitler and Nazis, and he is the first person to put the metabolic story of cancer on the map. So it was a fascinating conversation just talking about how the story of cancer research has evolved from how cancer cells eat to the discovery of oncogenes to coming full circle and making the connection between the two and what the debate still holds in the story. We also talk a lot about how cancer cells might be taking up a lot of glucose and feed on sugar and the connection between obesity and cancer. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the Live Longer World podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What was Warburg's initial research? Because he started with, you know, as you said, biology and perhaps studying respiration before he started studying more on the cancer side of things.
Yeah. His initial research was in the realm of respiration, and, you know, remained a mystery how cells breathe. You know, the example that I give in the book is, you know, we understand, of course, if you set a piece of bread on the counter, it's not going to burn, and yet somehow when we swallow it, it does burn in our bodies, and yet we don't fortunately have the heat of a flame in there. So there has to be some processing. You know, now we know how enzymes speed up reactions and make all this possible, but none of that was understood at the time. It was really mysterious. So, you know, Warburg was working on that problem and studying sea urchin eggs, you know, single cells from sea urchins that would grow and multiply. And he was curious, you know, how they get the energy to grow. And one of his first, you know, famous studies, he just measured how much oxygen those sea urchin eggs were taking up as they grew and divided. He saw that the oxygen was increasing. And so, you know, he began to see the relationship between increased oxygen consumption and growth, and that, you know, played heavily into his thinking when he turned his attention to cancer cells, which was, you know, a very similar question. What do they need to grow? What are their energy needs? And, you know, it looks like even when he was studying sea urchin eggs, he already had cancer in the back of his mind. He understood that this was sort of a first step.
That's fascinating. And that's probably also because, as you mentioned, cancer rates were skyrocketing back then. It's still, I mean, much lower compared to what they are right now. But back then in Germany and even other parts of the civilized world, there was this phenomena. Why is cancer skyrocketing so much? Speak to that, like, because there were other people who were also studying this phenomena. What was the thought process back then in regard to what is going on with cancer?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of Warburg's story. German science was leading the world. You know, to be a scientist, you really had to speak German in many different fields, to read the journals. And they had really dominated in infectious diseases. Robert Koch, the famous, you know, microbe specialist, figured out that specific microbes could cause specific diseases like tuberculosis and anthrax, and it really changed the world. It seemed like German science was really conquering, you know, every different field. And, you know, the one disease that was growing more common rather than less common was cancer. Mm-hmm. And it was creating a panic that they couldn't figure out. And at the early stages, many people did think that it was a microbe. That was a leading hypothesis at the time. And they were searching for, you know, the cancer microbe. But, you know, they couldn't find it. And Warburg saw at a very early stage that it wasn't a microbe, that something else had to be going on. So, you know, because there was this cancer panic, you know, and because Warburg wanted to be the next Robert Koch, you know, the German hero who would save everybody, you know, that's why he gravitated to cancer. He actually didn't even have a particularly personal connection to the disease, but, you know, in his office, he had a big portrait of Robert Koch and Pasteur, and he saw them as heroes. And, you know, that was his attempt to become the great German of his generation, was to solve the great disease of his generation. And that was becoming cancer, because it was becoming, I mean, that was becoming cancer because it was growing more and more common. And, you know, one of the more controversial things I argue in the book is that it wasn't just that people were living longer, as is sometimes thought, that, you know, some people think cancer rates grew because we got better at diagnosing the disease or longer lifespans. But I, you know, early in the book, try to make the case as clear as possible that something else was going on. And I think the evidence is pretty clear on that point.
And you make the case saying that, you know, when doctors made trips to visit, say, other tribes who weren't living such civilized modern lives, they, a lot of them were living as long as us, but they weren't dying of cancer. So what was the phenomena that was seen there in the modern world versus people not living in the modern world? And do we know anything about what people in those tribes were dying of then?
As part of this discussion, I looked at, you know, these non-Western societies that were pre-industrial, and, you know, they did have shorter lifespans, but when you look at the evidence, it's actually that a big part of that is that many people would die in childhood and in early life. When you average that in, that makes a dramatic impact on the lifespans. And of course, you know, they're dying of infectious diseases and other conditions. But what they didn't seem to be dying of is were these diseases that were becoming more common in Western societies, these chronic diseases, you know, diabetes and cancer, and they had less heart disease. So, you know, these diseases that actually became known as diseases of civilization, you know, they used, that's a, kind of an offensive terminology, but that's how they called it at the time. You know, now you might say like diseases of industrialization. But, you know, something was going on, that these diseases were becoming much more common in some countries and were remaining relatively absent in other countries. And it's still, to some extent, it's still a mystery to this day why that is. But there was one very obvious clue from the start, which is that there was nothing special about the genetics. As soon as these societies would transition into, you know, a modern sort of Western diet, they too would get the very same diseases. You know, some of these doctors like Albert Schweitzer, who, you know, stayed in Africa for decades. When he first got there, he said, you know, direct quote, "I was astonished by the absence of cancer." But, you know, 2 decades later, he was starting to see it. And you've seen obesity, you've seen diabetes. So it was clearly something, you know, I think clearly something related to diet. But even then, it's extremely hard question because we eat many different things. And it's, you know, famously difficult to figure out which one is responsible for cancer.
And you mentioned one thing there where you said that it can't be solely attributed to genetics. And I know there's still debate there whether it's caused by, say, oncogenes or diet and food we eat. And we can, I'd like to get to that towards the end of the conversation. But going back to Warburg, when he started studying this then, what did he find about cancer cells?
Sure. So, in 1923, he does his first famous cancer experiment where he's expecting to see cancer cells behave very much like the sea urchin eggs he had looked at. He's expecting an increase in oxygen consumption to their growth, and is very surprised to see that cancer cells are not doing that. Instead, they're taking up more glucose and they're breaking it down via fermentation, you know, without oxygen. And you know, I describe it in the book for people that aren't familiar with this kind of science as like a backup engine. You know, burning fuel with oxygen in the mitochondria, which is often referred to as sort of the power center of the cell, that's a more efficient and better way to make energy. But if oxygen isn't around, then our cells have this other means, this backup engine of gaining energy by sort of splitting the glucose very quickly. You break it in two and basically spit it outside of the cell in the form of lactic acid. In the case of our cells, and in the case of some organisms, it's alcohol, of course, and that's how we get beer and wine. And with other organisms that are more like us, we get, you know, yogurt and our dairy products. So, you know, it's the same process that our cells have the ability to do. And it's kind of shocking. And as Warburg said, it seems like our cancer cells actually behave like yeast. They behave like microorganisms. You know, I said before, like, you know, why this was so confusing, because a lot of people at the time thought that cancer was actually caused by a microbe in the same way an infection is. And Warburg was saying, no, it's not that it's caused by a microbe, but that the cancer cells behave like a microbe. So that's an important distinction. And, you know, it's a very strange and surprising phenomena to see the similarity between the behavior of the cancer cell. And, you know, if you take yeast and you put them in glucose, and, you know, they immediately start multiplying as fast as they can and keep doing that for as long as they can. Yeah, that's basically what a cancer cell does.
Wow. And what was the reaction back then to when Warburg found this out?
Well, you know, in the very first years, there was a little bit of skepticism, but, you know, it became clear, you know, in a matter of years, as other people repeated the experiments, that what Warburg had found was real. That, you know, it really, cancer cell, not every type of cancer, but the majority, some say, you know, around 70% of cancer cells do this kind of aerobic glycolysis, which means they take up, they have oxygen, but they still choose to ferment, whereas you would normally think that a cell would only do this in desperation if they didn't have oxygen. So that part became less controversial over time. The part that remained and remains to this day controversial is why cancer cells do this. What triggers the process? And yeah, I don't know if we can talk about that, but yeah, that's the big question, the why.
Yeah, no, that would be amazing to talk about. Because so you mentioned that in the book that Warburg thought it was coming from the mitochondria. It was a defective mitochondria and also environmental carcinogens. What was Warburg's theory there on how the mitochondria might be involved?
Yeah, so Warburg becomes convinced at a very early stage that the defect has to be in the mitochondria and in the way that our cell use oxygen. You know, the mitochondria weren't well understood at the time either, but you know, he thought, you know, I mentioned before he was a narcissist, so he thought about everything in very aristocratic terms, and he even thought of like a cell is like an evolved state in which, you know, we use oxygen, and deep in our evolutionary past, there was a more primal state in which we didn't use oxygen. And I think he thought of it in those terms. He said, in cancer, oxygen is dethroned. You know, that was a very
Warburg.
So he thought if a cell isn't using oxygen, there must be a defect, because why, you know, why would an evolved modern cell do such a thing? So he was convinced that was the problem. And the question for him was, you know, why does that defect arise? And he eventually became convinced that it did have something to do with diet. Yeah, he thought that, you know, we eat foods that have all sorts of poisons. There are poisons in our environment, carcinogens in the air. And he thought they caused the mitochondria to malfunction. And then the cell had no choice but to sort of shift to this other means of energy, and this backup engine, this glycolysis, sort of took over and led to cancer. I didn't conclude in the end that is the case in most cancers. It's one plausible mechanism, but I don't think it's the heart of this story. So despite Warburg in some ways being the hero of this book, I ended up kind of disagreeing with one of his central beliefs.
And you're saying the why is not the heart of the story, right?
Well, when I celebrate in Ravenous, I think it's his fundamental understanding that cancer can be metabolic, often is metabolic in origin, and that we have to focus on that. But the interpretation of the why, you know, I ultimately concluded that Warburg didn't have that story entirely right, but he nevertheless deserves credit for sort of putting the focus on the metabolic shift.
Exactly, when no one else was doing that back then. So you said there is still debate on the why then. What is the, I guess, what's the theory in the field, hypothesis in the field right now in terms of why cancer cells might be behaving this way?
Yeah, but there's a number of different questions. One question is sort of what's in it for the cancer cell? And, you know, through the leading hypothesis now is that, it's less about the energy that they can derive from the rapid glucose uptake and more about using those glucose molecules as building blocks for daughter cells. You know, cancer has a construction job to do. And although a lot of the glucose leaves the cell in the form of lactic acid, a lot of it is recycled into building blocks for DNA and lipids. So it gives cancer cells tools that they need to grow, and in some cases, or one leading hypothesis is that it's really specifically about this molecule NAD that is kind of like a building tool for cells, and that if you bring in a lot of glucose and sort of strip it down, then you get these NADs that you need. So that's a leading hypothesis for what the cancer cell needs from this rapid glucose uptake. But in terms of the sort of related question of why cancer begins, what triggers this metabolic process, that's, a whole other level of controversy. It could just be, the sort of the classic theory that you just get an unlucky mutation and it causes the cell to go into this hyper-eating mode. And certainly in some cancers, that's the case. But my sort of starting argument is that we know there's a connection between diet and cancer and it has something to do with obesity. And we know that cancer cells overeat. Is it possible that the two things are related? Is something about our diets actually pushing a cell into this mode? And again, Warburg's argument was, yes, there is, and it's the poisons in our food. And my argument ultimately would be that the most compelling evidence is that our diets are changing our hormones, specifically the hormone insulin, insulin-like growth factor, these growth hormones, and those growth hormones are actually causing the cancers that we associate with the modern diet.
Mm-hmm. And one thing you mentioned was that, one of the debates is that it might be caused by an unlucky mutation, and then cancer cells feed on this glucose to grow and then to grow out into daughter cells. So when you say, when we look at the cancer-diet connection, do you think that the diet could be causing this mutation, or do you think... it's regardless of this mutation, the genetic factor that cells become cancerous and start behaving this way?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's very hard to tease out the earliest stages. I think the leading hypothesis, is that these mutations crop up all the time, that all of us, even those of us who are healthy, get these microscopic tumor cells that would normally be killed off by the immune system or would remain sort of dormant, but in the environment with hyperinsulinemia, when you have this growth factor going through you all the time, those cells that would otherwise experience cell death, this apoptosis, where they just die by suicide, instead they're sort of given this this little encouragement, stay alive, stick around, grow a little. So those particular mutations that respond to insulin are the most common mutations in cancer. They're linked to what insulin does inside the cell. So I don't think that can be a coincidence that these mutations are the most common, and also that cancer cells are covered in insulin receptors. So once they gain the ability to take up just a little more insulin, there's no more getting rid of them. And, it's just a matter of time, more mutations arise. And it's certainly true that, something like what Warburg described happened as cancer evolves. Cells do have a harder time getting the oxygen they need because the blood vessels are cut off. And that does actually, encourage even, sort of faster fermentation and glucose uptake. So, it's a complicated story with different pieces, but I think the key factor, not in every cancer, but in many cancers, and I think most likely the best explanation for why cancer became so much more common, is that these diets that lead to higher levels of insulin and insulin-like growth factor are ultimately giving, you know, microscopic tumors a chance to thrive when they otherwise wouldn't.
That's a really good point, because then it sounds like, you know, it's hard to tease out what the primary or the initial cause might be. Like, maybe yeah. it's just an unlucky mutation or something in your genes. But yeah. it sounds like once you start fueling that with insulin-heavy diets or sugar-heavy diets, it just gives the cancer cells a chance to keep growing. Whereas otherwise, as you said, it may have been suppressed by immune system.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to stress that, you know, this argument that I talked about, you know, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, we see all these populations that, you know, we're not getting cancer. But that's not the only evidence. This evidence continued to amount throughout the 20th century. One famous example is that, you know, you saw Japanese women had very low levels of breast cancer, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And then you would follow Japanese women who came to the United States, and their daughters and granddaughters would start to have breast cancer in the same level. So it was just moving to another country. You know, there's other possibilities. It could be more sunlight exposure. It could be exposure to certain viruses that cause, you know, it's not the only thing, but, you know, diet was clearly playing a role. And a lot of people, you know, don't realize it. Even to this day, you know, expert opinion is, you know, anywhere from 50 to 70% of diets are of cancers are caused by our environments. So that, again, that doesn't mean only diet, but I think that, you know, the evidence is much stronger for the environmental component than many people realize.
Exactly. And I was talking to Dr. Dom DiAgostino as well, and he told me that anecdotally, a lot of people actually email him saying that they've cured their cancer, or they've at least made it better by just going on very strict ketogenic diets, which is extremely low on insulin and just sugar diets. And I believe there are some stories as well of people who practiced a lot of fasting, prolonged fasting or caloric restriction, which is something you write about in the book as well. And that too helped some people with cancer, at least.
Yeah. Well, I do want to comment. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I thought at the end of the book, I thought about adding a chapter telling the stories of people who have had tremendous success with their cancer, with the ketogenic diet or whatnot. I decided not to do it because of, you know, I've heard these incredible stories, and, you know, I have tremendous admiration for people that are doing it, but I just didn't feel comfortable writing that because, you know, we just don't know enough yet. I think the evidence for prevention is very strong, whether going on a ketogenic diet, you know, will ultimately help you. I mean, there's been some promising looks with specific types of brain cancers, but I think it's too soon to say. And once you have cancer, it's a, you know, a whole separate story. You know, I'm excited about one study that's going on right now, which combines ketogenic diet and chemotherapy, but we just don't know yet. So my message is, you know, really about prevention, about staying in good metabolic health for the purposes of prevention. But I know Dom, and, you know, I think he's doing amazing work. So, you know, I'm glad he's leading the way on some of that stuff.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I mean, I do hope there's a lot more data that comes out, so we'll at least know much better, especially as it relates to once you do have the unfortunate event of having cancer, what can we even do about it then? One thing I think is fascinating in this story is that, you know, Warburg finds this out, and he finds out how cancer cells eat and the whole fermentation process that's going on, which that still exists to this day. But then it was largely forgotten for a long, long time. And that's probably, as you elaborate in the book, that's because Watson and Crick made their discovery of the DNA. So everything starts becoming, oh, it's everything's about the DNA, everything's about genes. And then more people, oncogenes got discovered in the 1970s as well. What happened in that period of hibernation regarding the metabolic story of cancer?
Yeah, that's another fascinating part of the story. You know, after the war, Warburg really disappears from the scene. I mean, he survived and is still in Germany, but, you know, in the 50s and 60s, he starts to fade away. And, you know, by the 80s and early 90s, just, you know, vanish. Like, nobody knows about him. So part of it was, you know, Warburg's own hypothesis for what, what's going on, was debatable. And, some people were doing experiments and saying, look, cancer cells actually do use oxygen. Warburg was saying, once they shift over, there's no more oxygen. It's, that's the entire story of cancer. He had a meeting before, a conference of Nobel laureates and told them cancer cells make a complete shift to fermentation and nothing else matters. That's all they need to know about cancer. So he was making these extreme statements that didn't help. But, as you mentioned, I think the biggest thing that really sort of was the nail in the coffin, if you will, was the discovery of oncogenes in the 70s. Warburg had died in 1970, and then this new discovery in the 1970s, that there were specific genes that in mutated form could cause cancer, seemed like, all the old biochemistry, how a cell takes up glucose, was like old world science. And this is the new, the new exciting era in which we're going to figure out the specific mutations and how to target them. And that will be that. And metabolism just, disappeared. These charts that they used to have on the walls of all the metabolic pathways were taken down. And, when scientists talked about literally seeing, Warburg manometer, that used to study energy levels in the garbage outside of his lab. So it just disappeared. But the crazy aspect of it is, even as that was disappearing, this new cancer test had come onto the screen, the PET scan, which really all it does is look at, where glucose is being taken up more in the body. And that's how you diagnose the cancer. So in a way, it was staring everybody in the face, and yet it was somehow gone. And fortunately rediscovered, part of it is, just science naturally sort of is, there's a pendulum like phenomena. People get excited about new ideas and forget others, but Warburg certainly helps the process along with his behavior.
Yeah, I like how you have this sentence in the book where when Warburg talks to some of these scientists about fermentation of cancer cells and others, they disagree. And he just says that, I've already cured cancer. We already know why cancer happens. We don't need to discuss this anymore.
Yeah. Someone talked to him about starting like a new institute. So no need. I've done this.
But I also think Warburg's story with World War II is interesting because he's this Jewish gay man. And, when World War II breaks out, he's told that there's only one condition which he can live, and that's if he chooses to study cancer. And that's likely because Hitler had a personal connection with cancer where his mother died of breast cancer. What was the state of Germany and scientists and just the connection with Warburg back then?
Yeah, so in 1933, when the Nazis come to power, Warburg is really at the height of his influence. In 1931, he had won the Nobel Prize for study of respiration. He's already made his important cancer discovery. The Rockefeller Institute, an American institute, has built this, beautiful institute for him in Germany, which is kind of crazy because it wasn't that long after World War I, and Americans are funding German science. So when Hitler comes along, he can hardly believe that, his status is being challenged. He had a Jewish father, but wasn't sort of, publicly Jewish, and he was gay, but was also, more or less, he lived with his male partner, so he wasn't exactly in the closet, but, he didn't talk about being gay. But so he had every reason to be extremely fearful, but he was incredibly arrogant, couldn't, he called the Nazis low-life thugs. He couldn't believe that they were going to come and tell him what to do, and, he refused to do the Hitler salute. He refused to put up a Nazi flag. So in a lot of ways, he was really admirable, and it was amazing that he did that. But, the more I learned, the less, in some ways, I admired him. Part of me still admires him, but I saw that, what really drove him crazy was not the cruelty of the Nazis. It was just that they were bothering him. He just couldn't stand that anybody would mess with him in any way. So he's kind of a hero for standing up to the Nazis, but I'm not sure his motivations were always that great. He thought about leaving. Most Jewish scientists did, but he chose to stay. And it's, out of these Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, which had hundreds of Jewish scientists, he was the only one to stay all the way to the end and survive. And, it's a pretty remarkable story. And as you mentioned, I think it ultimately comes down to the Nazis being very afraid of cancer. Many of the top Nazis were hypochondriacs, and Hitler in particular was focused on cancer. And, you know, for some of the reasons we talked about before, cancer had been growing more and more common, and Hitler lost his mother to cancer. And so, you know, Warburg had already made a huge discovery. He was telling everybody that he was going to cure the disease, and they had reason to think he was right.
What do you think made Warburg so arrogant?
Yes, it's a good question. You know, it could be that, you know, he grew up in a, you know, environment that we talked about where everybody around him was, you know, he was actually born before the Nobel Prizes were given out, but they all went on to win Nobel Prizes. And, you know, he certainly thought from a young age that he was in a circle of great people and that he would be great. But my take is that it was ultimately largely innate, you know, that some people are just born with that kind of personality. And, you know, he would have turned out that way anyways. But, you know, it's really, you know, it's hard to know. But, you know, certainly, you know, growing up with such famous people probably helped it along.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Even if it was innate, just growing up in an environment where he's hanging out with Einsteins and Max Planck, so even though it was before the Nobel Prize, he obviously knew they were prominent scientists. And and his dad was that. His cousins were also the famous, the financial Warburgs.
Yeah, and, you know, when he was off in World War I, Einstein wrote him a letter, you know, telling him he was so important to German science that he had to get home. So other people were fueling this belief. I think Einstein actually wrote that precisely because Warburg was a narcissist and he knew that's what would appeal to him. But, you know, the surprising thing is that most people that are so full of themselves are actually not brilliant, but he actually was, you know, truly brilliant and full of himself. So you could back it up more than most.
That's right. Yeah. So what happens then? You know, oncogenes come into the stage, and then the metabolic story kind of goes under the blanket, but then it gets revived again in the late 90s. How does it get revived? And when it does, we already spoke about some of the whys, but what do people find out about the new connections?
So, you know, one of the first people to rediscover the connection was Chi Van Deng, who actually sat Johns Hopkins and then went to Penn, where he studied and made some key discoveries there. But what amazed me is when he sort of rediscovered Warburg, you know, another scientist took him aside and said, you know, just want to warn you that you're getting into some complicated political territory here. So even, you know, decades after Warburg died, those sort of controversies about him were still around. You know, some people suspected him for having collaborated with the Nazis. So that was, you know, part of the story as well. But the key was really that they were studying these oncogenes and, you know, trying to understand you have a mutation and that mutation sort of turns on an enzyme in the cell, causes it to misbehave. You know, what are these genes doing? And, you know, one of the scientists, like Chi, described it to me as, you know, almost like being a cartographer where you're sort of tracing a map through the cell, trying to how one protein affects another protein, how it affects another protein. And so she was looking at this oncogene called MYC, which is a gene that turns on a lot of other genes, and trying to understand what it was doing in a cell. And what he saw was that it was actually, you know, among other things, was actually turning on this Warburg, you know, what's called the Warburg effect, where the cell does this shift to fermentation. And then other scientists looking at other genes and other mutations were starting to see the same thing, that these famous oncogenes were actually controlling how a cell eats, how a cell takes up nutrients. So it was kind of this synthesis that, you know, all these ideas that Warburg had, which he thought had nothing to do with genes, and all the gene mutation people thought they had nothing to do with biochemistry, suddenly, you know, they started to come together and to see that the oncogenes were actually, you know, having a huge role in the uptake of glucose and other nutrients and how they're processed. So again, that doesn't solve the question of what turns on the process, but it shows that they're deeply linked. And, you know, as Chi explained it to me, it made perfect sense that the oncogenes were doing this, because, you know, if you have a cell that needs to grow and divide, you know, it's like putting up a building. And if you can't control how the nutrients are flowing in, you can't control the construction materials, the building is going to collapse. You can't build unless you also take control of the supplies. So that's what these genes like MYC and AKT are doing, they're sort of allowing a cancer cell to get all the fuel that it needs.
So when the cancer cell needs this fuel, why is glucose its primary source? Why can't it just use fat or protein as fuel to grow as well?
Yeah, I mean, and there are, you know, there are sort of more nuanced studies going on in terms of, you know, some cancers relying more on fats and proteins. But glucose, is sort of the first step, you know, to some extent, I think you have to look at it through an evolutionary lens of, you know, glucose being sort of, from that perspective, kind of ubiquitous and quick energy. It's kind of the fastest way to get what you need and grow. We all always have running through our blood, you know, no matter what diet you're eating, you have glucose going through your blood at all time. You would, you know, die, of course, quickly if you didn't. So the glucose is always available. And, you know, if a cell can just, you know, get, you know, as we talked about before, just the ability to take advantage of that situation, it's a huge advantage. And, you know, it's kind of the amazing thing about our biology is that in a normal cell, you know, it's almost like a socialist or a communist system. This glucose is always there, but they only eat when they're instructed to, you know, eat for the most part. And, you know, this hormone insulin flows through our blood and basically gives cells permission to take up that glucose, to take it up and eat it. So normally, you know, a cell sort of resists the temptation. But when, you know, cancer cells get this message from glucose, this fuel that's always around, then, you know, it's a shift from the socialist system to a capitalist system. Then they're just going to take up all the glucose they can. And, you know, unlike fats or protein, you know, it's always there for them.
That's a fascinating analogy. You mentioned there's some studies going on with cancer cells taking up fat and protein. Are you aware of any of the more intricacies behind the studies?
Yeah, I haven't, you know, I'm not an expert in that area, but, you know, what is interesting, I think, is that, you know, in some cases, you know, they've been able to identify cancers that thrive on specific amino acids, and glutamine in particular is this big area of interest. But, you know, now there's a new company that, you know, some of these leading scientists that are interested in and have made a lot of these breakthroughs are now specializing diets based on the type of cancer that you have. This is totally new stuff. So in some cases, you know, it might be, and I think in many cases, the majority of cases, it would probably be something that's more ketogenic-like or, you know, low in glucose. But in other cases, the diet might be formulated specifically to, you know, avoid one specific amino acid. And, you know, we don't really know yet if that's going to work, but it's, you know, it's an exciting development. And I do think that, you know, most cases, these will be adjunct therapies, you know, done in adjuvant therapies done in conjunction with chemotherapy or other, other treatments. But, you know, I think that's hugely important because, you know, already we've seen, you know, in some early studies that therapies that work, you know, only modestly when added with the ketogenic diet, it makes a, you know, tremendous difference in the early stages. So I'm very excited to see where that research leads.
I am too. Yeah. You mentioned Chi when he was getting into the study of the metabolism behind cancer. You know, a lot of people warned him that this field might be loaded with more controversy or politics, and perhaps also because people knew that, you know, Warburg may have collaborated with the Nazis. Do you think that might have been a big reason why no one touched it, where because it had the stigma of the Nazis, no one really wanted to go back into that research again?
Yeah, well, I don't think it was necessarily the only thing, or maybe not even the main thing, but it definitely played a role. And in fact, I know because one of the people involved was very open about it. Robert Weinberg, who is, you know, wonderful scientist, made huge important discoveries about oncogenes, told me, you know, very clear that his family was German Jewish and he resented Warburg for staying in Nazi Germany. And it was Weinberg who famously in the year 2000, I believe, wrote this paper called The Hallmarks of Cancer, which It's one of the most famous cancer papers ever written. It identifies sort of the six fundamental aspects of what cancer is, and he left off metabolism. And he told me he didn't like war, but he didn't say explicitly like that's why he did it. But you know, he sort of left it open. And then 6 years later, he put out the first edition of his textbook, which is, you know, was a seminal like cancer textbook. And he also didn't, you know, have a single mention of Warburg or metabolism in there. But you know, I give Weinberg a lot of credit. He, in the second edition of his paper and the second edition of his textbook, he did add Warburg in. So he sort of admitted that he missed it, and it admitted that he was biased. So I have a lot of respect for people that can admit that kind of mistake. And you know, he was very kind to me. He even gave a blurb to my book, despite the fact that I was, you know, critical to some extent. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I think that's definitely cool, especially that's the only way science can progress, right? When you take criticism and actually correct your errors.
Yeah, I think so too.
So what is the main criticism people have of this insulin cancer connection? The ones who say don't agree with it, they don't think that this is why cancer cells, this is what cancer cells are doing with sugar or insulin. What's the main criticism they have?
Yeah, I don't even think there is that much, you know, there's different things. A lot of people, what upsets a lot of people is I don't know about a lot of people, but I take another step in the book where I say, okay, it's insulin. I think a lot of people agree that insulin is a problem. But then the next step is, okay, well, what causes the hyperinsulinemia? And my argument is that it's refined carbohydrates and sugar. And that's where things get controversial, because a lot of people will say, well, it's just obesity. And I'll say, okay, but refined carbohydrates and sugars are causing that obesity. And they say, no, it's not that. It's just overeating. It's just too many calories. And you know, that is where a lot of the disagreement comes in, because I think it's hard to dispute at this point that hyperinsulinemia is responsible for some percentage of cancer. You know, maybe there's disputes about how much, but the evidence is not, you know, not as solid as we'd like. But at the very least, I think you can say that obesity is so strongly linked to many different types of cancer that whatever makes us obese is got to be part of this story, either directly or indirectly. My argument would be that the insulin IGF-1 is causing, you know, the insulin in particular causing both the obesity and cancer. Other people might say it's causing the obesity, and the obesity in turn is creating an inflammatory state, which then causes cancer. But one way or another, I think it has to be linked to whatever causes obesity. But then, you know, I mentioned Gary Taubes before, there's huge controversies about what causes obesity. So now, if cancer is connected to that story, then the cancer controversy is part of that. And, you know, I don't know if you follow this stuff on Twitter, but it can get pretty nasty on Twitter. And you know, the main debate seems to be, is it total calories or is it specifically, you know, carbs and sugar in particular? And I'm more in the sugar camp. You know, I've looked at the research, you know, the extent that I'm able, and I find that the evidence is quite compelling that the sugar is the number one factor.
Yeah, I'm with you too. And you mentioned that, you know, a lot of people who don't agree with the fact that it's, say, sugar could be a huge factor to obesity, say that, well, sugar consumption is on the decline in America, so shouldn't obesity be on the decline as well? Well, you give a counter argument that, well, okay, sure, it might be on the decline, but it's not enough to actually make that much of a difference to obesity. Or is there another argument there as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the argument. I mean, if you look at the graph from the 1900 and you see this tiny little dip compared to, you know, still vastly more than it was. And, you know, one of the things that was really shocking to me is I found a lot of articles from the 1920s and 30s where people at that time were bemoaning the sugar levels and talking about, you know, how much damage sugar was doing. And that was at a time when, you know, it was a fraction of what we have today. So if we could go back to those levels, you know, it would seem like a miracle. And, you know, already then, you know, people were noticing a connection between sugar and obesity, and even in some cases, cancer as well. So, you know, one, in response to what you said, you know, one response I've seen is that, you know, to say that, you know, the drop in sugar consumption would be enough would be like going from like three packs of cigarettes a day to two packs of cigarettes a day and then being surprised that there were still any problems. You know, it's just, we've got a long way to go. And, you know, based on what I see with my own eyes, like, I guess sugar consumption is going down according to the data, but it's truly astonishing. You know, I've got kids and it's hard for me to keep sugar out of my own home, despite all these beliefs, and everywhere they go, they're being given sugar. So I don't think it's going down that much. You know, maybe one area of progress is sugary beverages, and that's wonderful to the extent that's going down, but there's still an awful lot of that around as well.
Yeah, and I wonder what the nuances there are as well, because maybe sugar consumption is going down with a certain demographic or age group or something, and maybe that's broken out in the studies, but it's like, it's sometimes when you just look at the averages, it's so misleading. You can't really tell the full story.
Yeah, no, it's true, and it's no coincidence that, you know, in many poorer communities, you have more obesity and more of these metabolic cancers where, you know, there is more sugar consumption.
The other thing with, you know, just linking obesity to calories is that, sure, it might be that people gain weight when they're eating extra calories, but a lot of the argument about sugar is also that it affects how much you actually want to eat and the way you want to eat. Because when you keep having these constant glucose spikes, you just want to consume more food than when you have more stable blood sugar levels.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. It, you know, causes, you know, first the glucose and insulin to spike up, and then actually the reverse, you know, the insulin sends all the, you know, the glucose out of the blood, and then you get really hungry and end up eating more. And, you know, that's the perversity of the system, is that you have all this nutrients in you, but they're locked away in your fat cells with the elevated insulin, and it can't get out. So you actually end up feeling hungrier and eating more despite having all those nutrients stored.
Yeah, it's kind of sad how nutrition has almost become such a, like you said, all these Twitter debates, and it's just become a place for war. Like it's like anyone who mentions anything, nothing's taken seriously. Everything seems like people are in different camps, where I think a lot of people don't actually fall in that category. People are more open-minded about it, but it almost seems like everyone's just divided into different camps.
Yeah, it's hard. And, you know, I know to some extent that I might fall into that as well. It's hard to avoid. I try to not get into any kind of controversy on Twitter, and to be respectful of everybody. But you know, I have to always keep in mind that I've developed my own biases. When I see a new study, I have to take it seriously, even when it disagrees, you know, with what I, you know, come into this thinking. So I've been frustrated by what I see from others, but I try to be aware that I'm capable of it as well, and to stay on guard for it.
Yeah. But your story is also in the book, Rav, and it's also interesting because it just talks a lot about how science can be influenced by politics in general or personalities. And it's the same with nutrition as well, right? Where a lot of it can be influenced by what big corporations or industries want to feed us and what the marketing message is, or just the nuances of politics as well. Like I think more and more recently, reading a lot of these books or talking to people, I've kind of been very shocked by how science isn't so immune from just marketing and politics as I thought it would be as an outsider at first. So it's like, it's important to sometimes take all these factors into consideration.
Yeah, and you know, I was saying at the beginning of our talk, that was really shocking to me to sort of come across this evidence. You know, you grow up being a big believer in science, and, you know, I still am, but, you know, nutrition science is just really hard to do. You know, if you could only hook people and force them to eat only one thing for like decades, you know, you'd be able to figure it out, you'd be able to do a real controlled trial, but you just can't do it in nutrition. And, you know, all the things that have worked in epidemiology in terms of smoking, you can look at who smoked and who didn't smoke and then look at who got cancer, and it works pretty well. But that, we eat too many different things, it just doesn't work. So it gets really controversial, really hard to get to the truth, and it's so influenced by politics and marketing that it's hard not to be cynical. And that's, you know, something I'm fighting against when I write this book. When I talk about these issues, people say, oh, don't talk to me about diet and cancer, because every week I see a new study saying this causes cancer. And I understand that skepticism, but I'm trying to show, to the extent that I'm able, that there's a deeper story here that, that might explain some of these contradictions.
Mm-hmm. And I think you do a really good job at it and just keeping a lot of the controversies out of it and focusing on the science. So I definitely hope a lot more people read the book and understand, you know, this is research that's been going on for decades, and there is a long story to it. And hopefully going forward, we'll have, as you said, a lot more studies come out, a lot more rigorous studies, so we'll have more research there. One question I had on the obesity connection, because you mentioned with almost every cancer, you can see the correlation is very strong. Obesity leads to cancer rates. It's also, you see that with aging as well. But prostate cancer, I believe, is the one you mentioned. The research is doubtful there. Do we know anything about the connection there? Maybe why obesity might not be connected to prostate cancer or any other causes that might be going on?
Yeah, well, I the prostate thing is tricky. I think it's pretty clear that in some ways it clearly is connected to the obesity insulin story. What you do see is that it doesn't, unlike, you know, I mentioned there are 13 cancers that, that correlate very strongly with obesity, and they tend to be, by the way, you know, often the most deadly ones. The story with prostate cancer hasn't been as clear. Some studies have shown a clear correlation, others haven't, but what is clear is once you do get prostate cancer, your prognosis is considerably worse if you have obesity. So it's clearly related in some ways. Whether or not it's actually, you know, at the origin of the disease, it's not entirely clear. You know, maybe related to the sex hormones that are changed in the context of prostate cancer, may not respond to insulin in the same way. But I think that, you know, also looking from a therapeutic perspective, what's been helpful in terms of modification of insulin glucose. I think the broader story with prostate cancer is that you're better off keeping the glucose and insulin under control with that and that as well. And I think that will become clear in the years ahead.
When doing your research for the book and just talking to a lot of scientists in the field, is there anything you came across about cancer research that outside of, say, the oncogenes or the metabolic insulin connection that you thought is like an emerging field, emerging area of research?
Yeah, well, certainly it's kind of funny. When I started writing the book, I still felt like kind of metabolism was the hot new thing. And by the end of the time, you know, it took me 5 years, like I felt like immunotherapy had sort of already sort of emerged as the new exciting thing. So what happens when you take years to write a book. But you know, interestingly, I haven't followed it as close, but, you know, a lot of the exciting research now is going on sort of the interplay of, you know, immune metabolism and how the two fields are connected. So that's a big story now. But, you know, to me, you know, one thing that scares me is I feel like a lot of the scientists that are moving on to immunotherapy research, it almost feels to me like the pendulum is swinging again, but like we haven't actually solved this diet issue. Like I don't want to see people lose focus on metabolism before we get a better answer, because I don't think any other field, you know, in terms of, you know, metabolism is connected to what we eat, and you know that's so fundamental to the story that I don't want to see everybody sort of lose focus again before we get to the bottom of this.
On the immune side of it, it could also be the connection, right? Because then it begs the question, if it's our immune systems not behaving well and not eating up the cancer cells, which they would otherwise when we're younger, why is the immune system even going wrong? Maybe that's also something, like as you mentioned, like when people debate what is the cause of obesity, it kind of comes down to, again, like why is the immune system dysfunctional?
Yeah, I mean, you can think of it in terms of, you know, the COVID stuff as well, is that, you know, if the metabolism isn't working well, it's going to affect everything. And, you know, that's certainly why, you know, we've seen such differences in terms of response to COVID based on immune health, which is related to metabolic health. So you really can't, the metabolism is so fundamental, you can't separate it out. And, you know, I hope everybody remembers that.
Mm-hmm. And so Warburg's initial hypothesis was that, you know, the mitochondria is becoming defective. What's the consensus or the hypothesis in the field about the mitochondria now? in regards to cancer?
Yeah, so there are some people that, you know, I call them like today's Warburgians, and like Thomas Seyfried is, we may have come across his name. He's a prominent figure, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for putting metabolism back on the map. He was saying, you know, stuff about Warburg long before other people were. But he, you know, he has a very mitochondria-focused belief. But I would say, you know, again, as I talked about, when cancer has become more advanced, you know, then a lot of Warburg's ideas become more relevant. But in terms of the origins of cancer, I would say that, you know, the leading school is probably remains, just that, you know, unlucky mutations, you know, as you age, you get unlucky mutations. But, you know, for the people that are paying more attention to the kind of stuff that I'm writing about, I would say that, you know, that the insulin IGF-1, the insulin light growth factor hypothesis has really gained a lot of steam, and it, you know, it is pretty, you know, is much less controversial than it was even 10 years ago. And I think it's gaining more and more acceptance, and that, you know, eventually, I don't know how long it will take, but eventually it will become a mainstream view. And when that happens, you know, we will start to think of anything that causes obesity as being carcinogenic. You know, right now we still don't think of sugar as being a carcinogen, but I think eventually we will.
Yeah, that's right. And even in the aging field, you can see there are studies where, you know, when you lower the IGF-1, it's like mice end up living longer, which again is what you're saying, the insulin hypothesis, which again, yeah, like you can keep going back, and it could be caused a lot of it by sugar. So I do think there is a connection there, I guess. Yeah, people just want a lot more rigorous work done. But I'm also in your camp where I think it's important to look at both sides of the picture.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think everybody should agree that at the very least, we just need more research. Yeah, it's too important to ignore.
Yeah. What surprised you about Warburg's story, or just cancer research in general?
About Warburg's story, really everything. You know, it's just such an unlikely story of survival given his background. You know, I guess, you know, as I mentioned before, I was just really surprised by the extent to which the Nazis were fixated on cancer, and, you know, how much it influenced their thinking. You know, one story I recount in the book is that, you know, when Warburg was called into Nazi headquarters to figure out what to do with him, they were having all these meetings about Warburg and cancer, and that was only hours before they launched Operation Barbarossa, which was, you know, sort of the biggest, most important decision in the history of the Nazi movement. And even that day and that night, they were having debates about cancer. So that was very surprising. In terms of cancer research, you know, more generally, I guess, you know, what's surprised me again, you know, we've already talked about, but the extent to which, you know, science, you know, sort of goes in waves, and personality and politics influences, you know, even the most sort of fundamental decisions that are made. I mean, it's kind of obvious, but when you dig through the research, it kind of shocks you in a new way. You know, the other thing is that I, you know, some people read this book and they think that, you know, I'm sort of making an indictment of a specific scientist. I'm really not. You know, it's more, I think, you know, almost everybody was involved in terms of, not the Nazis, but on the science side, was well intentioned and trying to get to the truth. But, you know, when you become part of a dominant paradigm, you don't, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in it. And, you know, so, you know, dozens and dozens of years went on where nobody was paying attention to Warburg. It's not that those people wanted to solve cancer any less. You know, they were just caught up in the moment and the oncogenes, and there was reason to be hopeful. So it's very hard to escape that, the paradigm that you're in, and it takes a very long time for those paradigms to shift. But I do think we're seeing it now. You know, I occasionally post things on Twitter about very prominent institutions recommending ketogenic diets and things of that nature. So I'm starting to see it, but it's just a long process.
That's a good point, right? Because when every time there's a new discovery made, I mean, the younger scientists at least would want to work on that. Warburg sort of did the same thing where, you know, when cancer was skyrocketing, he wanted to be the one to discover why cancer is happening. So it's almost natural where, new discovery comes in, most of the people and all the bright minds would want to jump to that and first figure it out.
No, I totally get it. It's just the nature.
The first point you made was that it surprised you how invested the Nazis were in trying to figure out the cause of cancer. Do you think it was all stemming from Hitler and Hitler having lost his mother, or due to cancer, or was there something else going on too?
I think the deeper story was what I talked about before, that cancer was becoming more and more common and people were becoming panicked. I think, the panic had started before the Nazis in the 20s, and there was a big cancer exhibit that was touring Germany where people would line up to see, and there were all these, scary little, posters that they put up about, the big line at the time was, that 1 in 8 people could get cancer. And now, of course, it's, 1 in 2, 1 in 3. So it had already started, but then the Nazis, the leaders were literally crazy. I mean, in Hitler's case, literally crazy. And, Himmler was also deeply interested in cancer. His father had cancer. And, you look up and down the Nazi leadership and you have a lot of paranoid people, and that's one of the fascinating things to see is that, the same type of paranoia they had about the Jews was actually not dissimilar to the paranoia they had about cancer or microbes. It was this idea that the body is supposed to be pure and all these things are pollutants. One historian, Robert Proctor, who was who influenced my thinking a lot, said, that you can think of the entire Nazi project as a hygienic project to purify the body. And in their mind, the Jews were one more impurity. So they were obsessed with these kind of questions. And I think that it wasn't just Hitler. It was kind of like this strange ideology that he was at the center of.
Fascinating. Well, all right, Sam, is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't discussed?
No, we've discussed a lot. I just wanted to thank you. I can tell that you read the book very carefully. I'm very impressed by you and your work. So thank you for having me.
Hi again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. I'm blown away by the pace of longevity research, and I want to keep bringing you great conversations with longevity scientists themselves. If you want to support the creation of the podcast, consider sharing it, leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, or signing up to be a premium member and receive transcripts. You can also donate on Patreon, which is patreon.com/livelongerworld, and connect with me on Twitter, where my handle is livelongerworld. Lastly, all information and resources can be found at livelongerworld.com. I want to leave you with a last thought, and that is, aging is universal. We can unite in this fight and be healthy forever. I can't wait, and see you next time.